back at, so just to re-pick back up on page 190, just to go over the triglyceride again and kind of start from there. We already know the structure of the triglyceride being the glycerol backbone, as you can see in figure 5.10 on top right of page 191. You have this glycerol backbone, which remember is a sugar, and glycerol is a sugar. And then attached to the sugar is three fatty acids. Fatty acids can be of any chain length. They could all be saturated. They could be some unsaturated, some unsaturated, some saturated. Different chain lengths, two different acids. The triglyceride just likes to be full. That's the thing. So if you have a glycerol, it wants those three fatty acids attached. So to digest it and break it down, it's wanting to kind of become a full structure again. The triglyceride functions. So the functions, once again, an energy source. Fat can be used as an energy source, or a triglyceride can be used as an energy source. Remember, the fat provides way more calories per gram than carbohydrates or protein. Protein and carbs are 4 calories per gram, and fat is 9 calories per gram, meaning it stores more energy and it's chemical balance. So, it can be used as an energy reserve. If you overeat, according to this book, you overeat, you will store fuel or store excess energy as fat. Okay? They say regardless of any food that you intake, you store in form of that extra food you're going to eat as a triglyceride in our adipose tissue or adipose cells. Good, so energy reserve at the bottom, page 191. Moving over to 192, insulation and protection. Yes, we store fat around our organs to cushion them and protect them and keep them warm, just in case you were to experience a cold temperature for long periods of time. Our fat would be used as insulation as well. And the one thing that I don't feel like I got too into last time was the carrier of fat-soluble compounds. Okay? Fat is a really, really good carrier of vitamins, of carotenoids and other fat-soluble phytochemicals, which is on the top right of page 193. When it says it carries fat-soluble compounds, that literally means that compounds will dissolve into the fat and then pass your digestive lining, once it's in the digestive lining and in your blood, those same molecules will be absorbed and dissolved into the fat and then go into your cell via that way. So fat is also a good carrier, specifically of the fat-soluble vitamins, which are A, B, E, and K, which are at the top right of page 193, and we're going to get into. They have in fact their own chapter further on in the book. Okay, so fat-soluble compounds, like fat-soluble vitamins, carotenoids and other phytochemicals, can also be transported via the fat or the triglyceride or fat molecule. And also sensory qualities. We have a fat tooth just as much as we have a tooth. Fat in foods is good. anybody ever smell something fatty? Literally the fat cooking in meat typically is what makes that possible. Like if it's pig or chicken sometimes, bacon. So there's a sensory element to fats, and especially when they're cooked. So then we have triglycerides in the food at the bottom of page 193. So basically what we're looking at is that dietary triglycerides are found in a variety of fats and oils and in foods that contain them. Fat is in all types of food. And we kind of mentioned this earlier when we talked about the omega-3 versus omega-6 ratio, but the sources of omega-3 and omega-6 fats top right of page 194, or top left, page 194. Those are just some ideas for you to understand what oils might contain the omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acids. What's important about omega-3 and omega-6? They are essential. So omega-6 and omega-3 cannot be produced by the body, and they are considered essential, meaning we need them in our diet. What else? Three might be considered the good or good for health fatty acid, and six is also good and essential for health, but in large amounts, six can be problematic because it promotes inflammation. Remember, most of our processed food system contains a ton of omega-6 without as much omega-3, and that's because omega-3 is very tough to preserve over long periods of time. So when they stick like preservatives in the things, unfortunately, the omega-3 fatty acids actually break down and go. They can't be stored on a shelf for a long time because they're very susceptible to oxidative damage, meaning that they will break out and turn into either trans fat or some other form of fatty acid. So omega-3s, you can't stick on a shelf for a long period of time and expect to eat them. So when the food industry processes food, they typically don't use a lot of omega-3 fatty acids because those will break out more quickly and wouldn't be able to have a food that they edible because it didn't break down into some of the cutting or either food coloring or So this is why the food industry doesn't use omega-3 very much, that's why it's not very high in our diet. Does that make sense? The food industry doesn't like using omega-3 because it's not really last very long. Yeah, I like longevity, that could work. It's even a better one. Alright, so, but omega-6s are a lot more stable because they have one less double bond. And omega-6s can be used in all types of food, and they're essential, so people just say, oh, we think they have some of the essential fatty acids. But in all reality, it's not going to best for health because if you have a ton of omega-6 or a higher concentration of omega-6, like in, if you look on page 194, high omega-6 foods are like sunflower oil, corn oil, soybean oil, cottonseed oil, peanut oil. Those ones are going to have a lot of omega-6 and tend to be pro-inflammatory. Remember, you need a little bit of omega-6 because you want the blood clotting and the inflammatory of the omega-6, or when you get injured, like if you cut yourself, you want to be able to inflame an area in order to help that area heal. If it has high omega-6 and doesn't have very much omega-3, you're looking at too much pro-inflammation and not enough anti-inflammation from the omega-6. Okay. So then you're looking at what foods might be high in omega-3 and what foods might be high in omega-6, or sorry, just omega-3. Table 5.3 at the bottom here, page 194. So what is high in omega-3? We have, so there's some basic oils here. I'd rather look at the foods though. Sockeye salmon, so cold water fish, guys, has probably the highest concentration of omega-3. That's why fish is considered to be pretty dang healthy, especially fatty fish. But remember, it's typically wild-caught fish, because if it is a farmed fish, like farmed salmon, or just says regular salmon or something, it doesn't say wild-caught or wild-grown or whatever. Typically, that means they feed it some pellets that are corn-based, which decreases its total amount of omega-3 and increases the total amount of omega-6 for fish. And farmed salmon is not as healthy and as wild caught. So if you have the choice and it's not too much more expensive, get the wild caught. If you like that. Then you have mackerel, another fatty fish. Okay, mackerel would be cold water. Then you have flounder, it's a lean fish, but it does have that with it. Then you have some shrimp. Shrimp has some good omega-3. Cod liver oil and salmon oil. So this is, if people ever supplement with fish oil, that's pretty much the reason why. If you get a high concentration of omega-3 into your diet. Because in most of the food processing system, what do they do when they process the food? They actually take out omega-3s to increase the substance. No, cold water. So, you can imagine you go to, warm water fish such as ahi tuna, a little less fat on it, a little less, omega-3. If you go more towards the cold water fish, they need to store more fat for it to stay warmer, therefore they're fatty, because it's fatty. Have you ever seen some ahi tuna? Great for people that want a little bit of that fish, but the omega-3 is, remember, only stored in fat of the animal. So cold water fish have more fat. Like sardines are a great way, they're cold water fish. Salmon, you have sea bass. Fish do have some metals in them. I mean, it's kind of like one of those things. If you're getting wild fish, but I mean, especially farm fish might have higher levels of mercury. I know for pregnancy, they don't want you to eat specific fish because they will get higher amounts of metals or something. But I don't know if that's really what I do. It's kind of one of the things where it's like, oh, you know, in case, you know, since mercury is bad and it's going to be this amount, and some fish that were tested have this amount, that's almost like a rarity. I don't know. But it would be worth potentially checking out. So what we were talking about earlier is cod liver oil, salmon oil. Oh, yeah, so it could be freshwater fish or it could be saltwater fish. But if it's cold water fish, you typically have a higher concentration of omega-3. Like cod typically are from lakes, right? So freshwater fish. That would be the main higher amount of omega-3. Who's talking about here with the fish oil? Typically, you want the high concentration of omega-3, which is EPA and DHA. We talked about that a little bit. They're just the two omega-3 fatty acids that are essential to the body and anti-inflammatory and very healthy. The heart health, brain health, they reduce cholesterol, all this good stuff. But if you eat a diet from nature, you're getting plenty of omega-3. If you eat a processed food diet like what America does, you're probably not getting plenty of omega-3. Why? Because say an American should supplement with omega-3 because they aren't going to get enough. I like it. Arsenal, I'm here today. You know, I'll just give an example. Well, here it is right here. Look at EPA versus DHA on page 194, table 5.3, omega-3 fatty acids in selected foods. One tablespoon of cod liver oil has 938 milligrams of EPA and basically 1.49 grams or 1,492 grams of DHA. If you were to do one tablespoon, that would be more than enough for the So one gram. So somewhere, I tell you, the fish oil that I have does not have that much, that high of a concentration. It has about 600 EPA to 800 DHA, but I don't know if that's for teaspoons or for minutes. But I have to check the serving size. But as long as you're getting just a little whack of omega-3 on a daily basis, you're fine. But remember, if you're eating any sort of wild caught food or natural diet of an animal can change something. The corn-based diet of farmed animals is not the same. That's why when you go into the market and you're choosing what kind of meat you have, you either get the very lean farmed meat, or you get whatever type of organic grass-fed or organic natural pasture, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so again, that's because omega-3 is anti-inflammatory, so very healthy. Omega-6 is anti-inflammatory and in large amounts in contact. What is the standard American diet today, Mara? We're learning. Everyone's like, we have 3 days of your time now. So now it gets into commercial processing of fats. When we talk about food, when we talk about processing, this is why we want to avoid processed food as well, because when you get into processing of fat, you can break down the integrity of the fat and create a less healthy product. We'll talk about it. So it says, in nature, almost all fats exist in combination with other macronutrients. In nature, where does fat typically come from? Animals, typically. Okay? Some things like avocados that have some fat, and other fruits and veggies might have some fat. But typically, or nothing to do with fat too, but typically in nature, if you were to eat from nature, if you're out there hunting or gathering all that stuff, most of your fat is going to come from animals. Okay? What macronutrient would be most commonly associated with fat? What other macronutrients? Protein, yeah. Right? So you're going to get protein and fat at the same time when you eat from animals. This is also why, vegetarians jump on the no protein or no animal meat sort of thing, because they're also vegetarians are typically low fat. Thinking in which the low-fat diet creates like nuts, and everybody thought they were healthy, and everybody thought they were Art's been doing some good research and showing me all the stuff he's finding about the... Oh, it turns out saturated fat's not bad. It doesn't even matter, actually. Which, guys, when you think about overall health, we're looking to be able to analyze the inflammatory aspect of health. So if our inflammatory health and our gut health is good, that's when we get really good health. What did it say? They generally occur with starchy and plant foods and proteins and animal foods. In earlier times, the only concentrated fats and oils available to people were obtained from a very simple processing, like rendering fat from meat and poultry, or skimming or churning the butter fat from milk. Steaming the oil from ground nuts or pressing a few oil-rich plants such as coconut and olive. So olive oil has been around for thousands of years, and the Greeks and people before them were pressing olives to get the oil. And that's because all the olive has a ton of fat still in it, and you actually squeeze an olive, you get fat. And when you squeeze vegetables, other like vegetables, you typically get fat out of them. You squeeze celery, you squeeze corn, you almost get very little fat. So that's massive non-inflammatory. So I highly recommend staying away from all vegetables, specifically more soybean oil, corn oil, vegetable oil, and even vegetable oil. You don't get fat from corn. It's like, hey, I'm going to squeeze this corn and just drop a fat in it. You actually squeeze an olive, you'll get like a drop of fat in the corn. Or they said like nuts and seeds, yes, you can have, you can press almonds or press peanuts from things that they put in it. So, we look after our ancestors, kind of think that sort of way. Nature's going to provide you with fat, it's going to be easily accessible. Process crap, like they have So technology came into play in the 1920s. This is a top right of page 195. And allowed production of pure vegetable oils. Okay. By officially removing edible oil from its source, processing has increased availability of calories worldwide. Processing reduces waste and prevents spoilage during normal use of storage. Does so by inhibiting destructive processes of hydrolysis. Okay. But it is processed and it's not processed. So, what is hydrolysis? Products containing unrefined fats and oils contain enzymes that hydrolyze oil by splitting fatty acids from triglycerides. Free fatty acids then perpetuate the damaging hydrolysis. Refining destroys the hydrolytic enzyme that removes most of the fatty acids. So hydrolysis is one way. Hydro means what? Yeah, water. So basically water basically breaks down with that one. And then oxidation, the more unsaturated an oil, okay, the more unsaturated an oil, saturated fats do not go through a process of oxidation, the more vulnerable it is to oxidation. Oxidation occurs when an unsaturated fat comes in contact with air, and oxygen atoms attach at the double bond sites on the fatty acid chain. Oxidation rapidly turns fats rancid and oxidizes fats, damages body tissues, particularly blood vessels. Okay, this is if you left omega-3, like fish oil, on the shelf at room temperature for over. Oxygen is going to make contact with oil, and then it removes and turns oil into what we call a trans fat, where it says oxidizes fats, or by adding oxygen atoms attach at the double bond sites on the fatty acid chain, and they turn into trans fat. Fortunately, people avoid bad tasting and rancid fats. Okay? Exposure to light increases the rate of oxidation and shortens shelf life. The presence of small amounts of metals, which typically are removed by refining, also promotes oxidation. Then it says also on the next one, you get down into next paragraph, page 196 now. Unfortunately, processing has also has a negative side. To achieve stability and a uniform taste, potentially healthful phospholipids, plant cereals, and other phytochemicals are removed, and a significant portion of natural vitamin E is lost. Oils have become so familiar that we often forget that they are highly processed, highly refined foods, and further processing oils into solid fats, such as margarine, also produce undesired changes, like what's next, which is hydrogenation. I remember hydrogenation, guys. Hydrogenation of what again? Adding a hydrogen to replace the double bond, which is also known as hydrogenation, which is also known as what is in the back. So what exactly is hydrogenation? We really don't have to worry about this as much as we did about 10 years ago, because all of a sudden we now have everything posting like, oh, cook without trans fat, zero trans fat, zero trans fat, like they're advertising it in like McDonald's oil that they cook their fries in, zero trans fat or something. So to get a liquid vegetable oil to act like a solid fat, it must be at least partially hydrogenated. Hydrogenation involves breaking some of the double bonds in unsaturated fatty acids and adding a hydrogen. Okay, this process produces a harder, more saturated fat, one that is more effective for making baked goods and snack goods, and avoiding stuff like butter. So it says, although hydrogenation protects the fat from oxidation and rancidity, it also changes some of the double bonds in the fat structure to the trans configuration, and it basically turns it into a fake saturated fat. And what's the better alternative, regular butter or having margarine, which is actually harder to get. Butter has fewer saturated fat, or almost 50% fat, and it has a ton of calcium, Really quickly, we'll talk about phospholipids, page 198. Phospholipids, mainly what you need to know is that phospholipids are what, well, they have a phosphate group added to the fat, creating a different structure than the triglyceride. We see page 199, the structure of a generic phospholipid. What's the difference between the chemical structure from the triglyceride to that one right there? You have two fatty acids, and what do you add as opposed to having that third fatty acid? A phospholipid group. Okay. A phosphate group. So, because of that chemical change, you have a completely different type of fat. That fat now is going to be awesome and used for what are the functions of phospholipids on page 199? They're really good for our cell membranes. Phospholipids make up our cell membranes. If you look at page 200, you have some more functions to. Typically, the use of our cell membranes, that's what makes up all these phospholipids. If you can kind of see on page 201 in figure 5.20, that's like a phospholipid cell layer, cell wall. It's our hydrophobic heads, the hydrophilic tails, creating this barrier. And also at the bottom of page 200, figure 5.19, you have what the cell membrane looks like. Okay. So what else? Lipid transport, the ability of phospholipids to combine both fatty and watery substances comes in handy for the body and the stomach. Dietary phospholipids help break fats into tiny particles for easy digestion. And then also as emulsifiers, what is an emulsifier, guys? An emulsifier, so when you have a pure fat and a water-based substance, like oil and vinegar, what happens? It's separate. An emulsifier would basically take those two untangible sort of foods that they're willing to combine. An emulsifier would make them combine into one substance, such as when you have oil and vinegar, add an egg yolk to it, you get... mixes them together to learn that they're in the system. You can actually use that on your salad and stuff. Do like olive oil and balsamic vinegar with egg yolk and add that to your salad. That's the white. The egg yolk, yeah. The white would not be in the most part. The white would be perfect. That is an emulsifier. Because also, guys, there's an emulsifier that naturally flows in milk. And when you reduce that milk down for a while, sometimes it can separate, like through extra milk, and then it'll kind of but it'll separate a little bit too, so there is an emulsifier that is naturally in human stuff like and fine milk. That kind of help it make that's what phospholipids do. Well, so phospholipids in foods, really we don't need to worry about that too much. We get plenty of phospholipids just from eating normal fat. It's just very small amounts compared to triglycerides. Triglycerides, remember, make up about 95% of all the fat that we eat in children. Phospholipids and sterols make up the other 5%. But now let's get into, page 201, the top right, quick bite, says the power of yolk. Yolk. It's totally German, right? Or the... a single raw egg yolk is capable of emulsifying many cups of oil. Cooks take advantage of its natural emulsifying ability of egg yolks. Phospholipids to emulsify and stabilize preparations such as mayonnaise. Hollandaise sauce, molten or dressing. I get some butter, some lemon juice, and then a little egg yolk and set up and have some style dressing. Giving you guys ideas right now. But salivate over here. Food producers use fossils in emulsifiers and processed foods, which they make up for our infants. Also, they use fossil to emulsify so that's fun. Fossil lipids are cool. What do you really need to know about them? They make up our cell membranes and hydrophobic head, hydrophilic tails, meaning they separate oil and water very well. And good stuff. Lecithin. In the bottom left of your page 200, it says lecithin in the body, a fossil lipid with the I think that was supposed to say nitrogenous. Don't know why I'm not. Nitrogenous. They definitely put a U as opposed to nitrogenous. Yeah. That's gonna get me in trouble right there. In the body, a fossil lipid with the nitrogenous component choline, which has a ton of nitrogen. In foods, lecithin is a blend of fossil lipids with different nitrogenous. Oh yeah, this is a nitrogenous component. Not sure. Maybe for blood, some of you in blood, you might have some sort of blood issue that could be associated with that. Not exactly sure what, but Google art. Alright, sterols is the last type of fat that we need to go over. What is the main sterol that we all know? Cholesterol. Good cholesterol. Although classified as a lipid, sterols are quite different from triglycerides and phospholipids, both in structure and function, and the best known sterol is cholesterol. Okay. So as opposed to having like these carbon chains, the cholesterol is going to be more looking like it's going to have these hexagonal sort of structures, which may basically make it completely different than any sort of triglyceride. So sterol structure, as opposed to having like finger-like structures like triglycerides and phospholipids, these sterols have the ring structures and they don't contain any fatty acids, which confused me because typically that means they're probably not going to be a fat if they don't contain fatty acids. But since it is in a ring structure, and you do have this carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, carbon and hydrogen sort of compounds with the hydroxide on the end, you're going to have more of a fat. So what are the functions of cholesterol? There's a lot. Okay. Let's go over one fun one in the top left, page 202. So cholesterol, when hit by the sun in our skin, okay, actually converts into sterol hormone and vitamin D. Okay, so the sun is going to be extremely important for health in humans and men. Some animals that have the properties as well. But when we get sun exposure, the cholesterol stored in our skin will literally turn into vitamin D, and then from vitamin D it can go into things like testosterone and testosterone. Or it can go into other sterol hormones like progesterone. Or maybe glucocorticoids. Remember, glucocorticoids are good and bad. Remember, high elevated levels of like cortisol, glucocorticoids, which is a stress hormone, which is not beneficial. But then you have mineralocorticoids, androgens, and estrogens. Okay. But it has to be heated or to make contact from getting radiation from the sun. Okay. And cholesterol is a precursor to vitamin D and all the sterol hormones. If you get more sun exposure, you are healthier. Obviously not to the point of deep, deep burns. You just want that nice, adequate contact with the sun. Depending on the latitude, 30 minutes to an hour a day, or a higher latitude, 2 to 3 to 4 hours. Okay. I'm looking near and see all. But if you imagine us as humans in nature, we do a lot of sun exposure. Probably hours a day, especially if you live by the equatorial region. What happens to the pigment of people that live at equatorial regions? They're long. So the darker your skin tone is probably going to be more closer to the equator of your home tone. As you can see, I was probably in Antarctica and or the Arctic. based on the polar sun exposure, your melanin in your skin would evolve and adapt over time to be a darker, lighter based on what latitude you are at. So our ancestors that moved away from the equator and started living in the northern regions, their skin needed to be lighter in order to get the proper exposure to cholesterol in their skin. If they were not lighter, they would probably die or have to be sick of a lack of latitude. Remember, they didn't just all of a sudden hop on a plane and be up in northern latitude. They had to walk all the way up and 6,000 degrees to migrate. So this is why we have different skin tones all over. Good time. More cholesterol functions. Because of the publicity generated by its role in atherosclerosis, cholesterol is the best known sterol. But cholesterol is a necessary, important substance in the body. It becomes a problem only when excessive amounts